Chapter 2. Frozen Jews. One of my strange and vivid memories from my first trip to Israel when I was 9 years old is of a brief cartoon I watched at the Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv. The cartoon described the travels of Benjamin of Tudela, a 12th-century Spanish-Jewish merchant who documented his 6-year journey traversing the known world across the Mediterranean to Turkey, Israel, Egypt, Babylonia, and Persia, and reporting on India and China, staying with Jewish communities in each place and sharing crowded boats and wagons in between. The Diaspora Museum has since been revamped and rebranded as the Museum of the Jewish People, but in 1986, it was a dark and openly depressing place. Its dour displays about Jewish communities around the world all leading to a Scrolls of Fire atrium, describing how the hapless Jews in these communities were either expelled or burned alive. But the cartoon was bright and curious. Benjamin was a ridiculous bowling pin figure with googly eyes bobbing across the screen and cheerfully reporting on thriving Jewish communities around the world. The Jews in France who inexplicably lived in a castle. The Jews in Babylonia who had their own googly-eyed king. The Jews in Yemen who joined local Arab armies and stampeded with them in a cloud of dust. The Jews in Syria who pacified wiggly-eyebrowed assassins by offering free silk scarves. For reasons I could not articulate at the age of 9, I was utterly enchanted. I feel that same enchantment now when I am seduced by the travel industry's branding of the world as an amazing place full of welcoming people who, beneath it all, are actually the same. In reality, the more time I have spent in any of the 50-plus countries I have visited as a tourist, the more I notice the differences between myself and the inhabitants, and the more alienated, uncomfortable, and anxious I become. Yet colorful photos of exotic places on TripAdvisor lure me every time. So I was eager to make my way to a city called Harbin in a remote province of northeastern China, south of Siberia and north of North Korea, where the temperature hovers around minus 35 Celsius for much of the year, and where every winter over 10,000 workers construct an entire massive city out of blocks of ice. The Harbin Ice Festival dwarfs similar displays in Canada and Japan by orders of magnitude. Its enormous ice buildings laced through with LED lighting and sometimes replicating famous monuments at or near life size. It attracts over 2 million visitors a year. It needs to be seen to be believed. As I considered a trip to Harbin, my mindless travel industry scrolling took me to a list of other local tourist attractions, including synagogues. Yes. Synagogues, plural. And then I discovered something deeply strange. The city of Harbin was built by Jews. Jews have lived in China for more than 1,000 years, which is as long as they have lived in Poland. But the story of the Jews of Harbin and of Harbin itself begins with the railroad. Because before the railroad, Harbin did not exist. Like most Chinese cities you've never heard of, Harbin today is larger than New York, with a population around 16 million. But as late as 1896, there was only a cluster of small fishing villages around a bend in a river. That year, Russia received a concession from China to build part of the Trans-Siberian Railroad through Manchuria, the traditional name for the vast, frigid, and at that time, barely populated region of northeastern China. Building this route would shave precious time off the trip from Moscow to Vladivostok. The route would also include a branch line deeper into China, requiring a large administrative center at the junction, essentially a town. Mikhail Grulyov, a Jew who had converted to Russian Orthodoxy in order to become a general in the Russian army, selected the site that became Harbin. With an enormous investment to protect, railroad officials quickly realized that they could not depend on local warlords or Siberian peasants to create this not-yet-existent town. They needed experienced Russian-speaking entrepreneurs. But who would ever want to move to Manchuria? The Russian Minister of Finance, Sergei Yulievich Vitte, hit on a genius idea. The Jews. Russia's crippling anti-Semitic laws and violent pogroms were already driving hundreds of thousands of Jews to America, including my own ancestors. Vitte argued to the regime in St. Petersburg that to get capital and talent to Manchuria, one only had to tell the Jews that they could live free of anti-Semitic restrictions without learning a new language or becoming bottom feeders in New York sweatshops if they moved there. The regime reluctantly agreed. So did hundreds and then thousands of Russian Jews. The first Jews arrived in 1898 and incorporated an official community in 1903. In only 5 years, the plan was working splendidly. A 1904 National Geographic article written by a U.S. consul to Manchuria reported, wide-eyed, that one of the greatest achievements in city construction that the world has ever witnessed is now going on in the heart of Manchuria, and that the capital for most of the private enterprises is furnished by Siberian Jews. These Jewish entrepreneurs created Harbin's first hotels, banks, pharmacies, insurance companies, department stores, publishing houses, and more. By 1909, 12 of the 40 members of Harbin City Council were Jewish. These initial entrepreneurs were later joined by new Jewish veterans of the 1904 to 1905 Russo-Japanese War, then by Jewish refugees fleeing the 1905 Russian pogroms, then by even more refugees fleeing World War I and the Russian Civil War. At its peak, Harbin's Jewish community numbered around 20,000. The old synagogue was built in 1909, and by 1921, there was enough demand for a new synagogue a few blocks away, as well as a kosher slaughterer, ritual bath, and matzah bakery, not to mention a Jewish elementary and secondary school, a hospital, a charity kitchen, a free loan association, an old age home, multiple magazines and newspapers, performances of Jewish music and theater, and Zionist clubs that were the center of many young people's lives, featuring not only competitive athletics, these clubs owned their own sports facilities and even yachts, but also rigorous study of Hebrew language and Zionist ideas. Harbin hosted major international Zionist conferences that drew Jews from all over Asia. Zionist parades were held in the streets. You already know this story has to end badly. Like almost every place Jews have ever lived, Harbin was great for the Jews until it wasn't. But in Harbin, the usual centuries-long rise and fall was condensed into approximately 30 years. The flood of refugees from the 1917 Russian Revolution included many non-Jewish white Russians, anti-communist royalists, whose virulent anti-Semitism was soon institutionalized in a fascist party within Harbin's government, and who burned the old synagogue in 1931. That was also the year the Japanese occupied Manchuria, noticed rich Jews there, and decided they wanted their money. Conveniently, white Russian thugs were ready to help. The Japanese gendarmerie embarked on a partnership with white Russian criminals, targeting Jewish business owners and their families for extortion, confiscation, kidnapping, and murder. Later, they manipulated the Jewish community for political purposes, sending Abraham Kaufman, a respected physician and the community's elected leader, off to two separate audiences with the Japanese emperor, and forcing him to publish official statements from Harbin's Jewish community announcing their love for Nazi-allied Japan. When the Soviets took over in 1945, they rounded up the city's remaining Jewish leaders, including Dr. Kaufman, and sent them to gulags. Dr. Kaufman endured 11 years in a gulag, and then 5 years in exile in Kazakhstan, before he was allowed to join his family in Israel. He was the luckiest. No one else survived. Then again, dying in a gulag was less dramatic than the fate of some Jews under the Japanese. While retreating from the Manchurian town of Hailar, the Japanese military beheaded its Jewish residents. By 1949, Chinese Maoists controlled Harbin. The 1,000-plus Jews still in town were gradually stripped of their businesses and livelihoods, while Israel's government made secret contact with Harbin's remaining Jews and began arranging for them to leave, a process that mostly involved submitting to extortion. As Walter Citron, an Israeli official responsible for facilitating Jewish emigration from communist China, explained, "It is obvious that the communist government is keen to clear the country of the foreign element. However, the authorities make things very difficult as long as the person who wants to leave is still in funds, and let the person go only after making quite sure that his personal funds are exhausted." The last Jewish family left town in 1962. After that, only one Jew remained in the city, a woman named Hannah Agra, who refused to leave. Leaning into the crazy old lady motif, she moved into a tiny room in the old synagogue. By then, the building, its interior subdivided, was being used as government office space, and died there in 1985, the official last Jew of Harbin. She wasn't quite the last, though. Today, there is one Jew in Harbin, an Israeli in his 70s, named Dan Ben-Kanan. Ben-Kanan was covering the Far East for Israeli news media when he was invited to teach at a local university, and he settled permanently in Harbin in 2002. Ben-Kanan is a busy man, not only because of his university responsibilities and his work editing local English-language news programs, but because his enormous research into Harbin's Jewish past has made him indispensable to the local government as they restore Jewish sites. So he is also basically employed as the semi-official one Jew of Harbin. Ben-Kanan spends enough of his time being the one Jew of Harbin that when I first spoke with him over Skype, he had his one-liner ready. I'm the president of the community here, which consists of me and me alone. It's great because I don't have anyone to argue with. Ben-Kanan's interest in Harbin's Jewish history, stemming from his days as a journalist, intensified when he learned that Harbin's government owned the Jewish community's official archives and kept them under lock and key. I tried to get them to reopen the archives and they refused, he told me. I've been given two reasons for it. One is that it contains politically sensitive material, and the other is that they're afraid of being sued for property restitution. There were some wealthy Jews here whose property was worth millions. The lack of access motivated Ben-Kanan to recreate the archives himself by collecting photographs, memorabilia, and testimony from more than 800 former Harbin Jews and their descendants around the world. As a result, as he put it, I've become an address for Harbin's Jewish history. When the provincial government decided, for reasons that only gradually became clear to me, to spend $30 million to restore, renovate, or reconstruct its synagogues and other Jewish buildings, they hired him. The one Jew of Harbin spoke with me for nearly 2 hours, because that was how long it took for him to describe the Jewish sites whose refurbishment he had supervised. There was apparently a lot to see. When I asked if I might meet him in Harbin in January, he laughed, explaining that he spends his winters in southern China. Winter here is not like winter in other places, he warned me. You can't just walk around outside. Come in the spring or summer instead. But I'd been lured by the city of ice, so he connected me with one of his former students who now worked as a tour guide, and I was on my way. There is a tourist industry concept, popular in places largely devoid of Jews, called Jewish heritage sites. The term is a truly ingenious piece of marketing. Jewish heritage is a phrase that sounds utterly benign, or to Jews, perhaps ever so slightly dutiful, suggesting a place that you surely ought to visit. After all, you came all this way, so how could you not? It is a much better name than property seized from dead or expelled Jews. By calling these places Jewish heritage sites, all those pesky moral concerns about, say, why these sites exist to begin with, evaporate in a mist of goodwill, and not just goodwill, but goodwill aimed directly at you, the Jewish tourist. These non-Jewish citizens and their benevolent government have chosen to maintain this cemetery or renovate this synagogue or create this museum purely out of their profound respect for the Jews who once lived here and who, for unstated reasons, no longer do, and out of their sincere hope that you, the Jewish tourist, might someday arrive. But still, you cannot help but feel uncomfortable and finally helpless as you engage in the exact inverse of what Benjamin of Tudela once did. Instead of traveling the world and visiting Jews, you are visiting their graves. Harbin was enjoying a heat wave when I arrived, a balmy 10 below, with a wind chill of minus 18. I only needed to wear a pair of thermals, a shirt, a sweater, a fleece, a parka, a balaclava, a neck warmer, a hat, gloves, 3 pairs of socks, and 3 pairs of pants to go outdoors. My first stop was the city's Jewish cemetery, billed by tour companies as the largest Jewish cemetery in the Far East. Except that it's not a cemetery, since cemeteries contain dead bodies, and this one doesn't have any. In 1958, Harbin's local government was redesigning the city and decided that the Jewish cemetery, home to around 3,200 dead Jews, had to go. The city offered families the option of moving their dead relatives' graves to the site of a large Chinese cemetery called Huangshang, an hour's drive outside the city, for the price of about $50 per grave. Many Jewish families were long gone by then, so only 812 graves were moved, and as it turned out, only the gravestones, since city authorities saw no reason to move the bodies, too. The human remains from the old cemetery are now in what the Chinese call deep burial. That is, the space containing them has been paved over and turned into an amusement park. It is nice for them to be there, my tour guide, whom I'll call Derek to keep him out of trouble, said of the dead Jews under the rides. They are always with happy people now. The drive to Huangshan took about an hour through industrial wastelands and frozen fields, culminating in a grandiose toll plaza with enormous Russian-style onion domes and then several miles more of abandoned warehouses, with a few people bundled by the roadside selling stacks of fake money to burn as offerings, because Huangshan is really a vast Chinese cemetery filled with endless rows of identical shiny white tombstones on many plots containing cremated remains. After driving past tens of thousands of dead Chinese people, we found the entrance to the cemetery's Jewish section, paid our fee, and entered the gates. The Jewish section was compact and stately, with roughly 700 gravestones elaborately carved in Hebrew and Russian, along with many modern metal plaques sponsored by former Harbin Jews whose relatives' original stones hadn't been moved. Many of the original grave markers had ceramic inserts with photographic portraits of the deceased, which would have been intriguing if every single one hadn't been shattered or removed. The damage was clearly deliberate, which might explain why a cemetery employee kept following us around. The idea that Jewish cemetery desecration was currently in vogue in Harbin was a tad depressing, but to my surprise, this snowy Jewish heritage site didn't feel at all lonely or bereft. In fact, it was rather glam. Inside the gate was a plaza with a massive granite Star of David sculpture next to a two-story-high domed synagogue building festooned with more Stars of David. The synagogue's doors were locked, but through its windows I could see that the building was a shell, with nothing inside but some scattered tools and junk. When I asked what the building was for, Derek laughed. "They built it for Olmert's visit," he explained. "Now it's just used by the cemetery workers to stay warm." Ehud Olmert, a former Israeli prime minister who served prison time for corruption, had roots in Harbin. His father was born there, and his grandfather, or at least his grandfather's gravestone, was in Huangshan, a gravestone that had now been outdone by a 12-foot-high black marble obelisk. The obelisk, crowned with yet another Jewish star, was carved with greetings written in English in Olmert's handwriting and painted in gold. "Thank you for protecting the memory of our family and restoring dignity into the memory of those who were part of this community and, illegible, a reminder of a great Jewish life which a long time ago was part of Harbin." The words were a dashed-off scribble, suggesting that Olmert didn't quite expect them to be set in stone. His grandfather's gravestone had been replaced with a black and gold marble one to match the obelisk, outshining the plebeians with their smashed ceramic photos. Near his grave stood a trash can designed to look like a soccer ball. Olmert's visit to Harbin in 2004 as Israel's deputy prime minister had been a big deal, but the fake synagogue built in his honor at the also-fake cemetery was just one part of an enormous and expensive project on the part of the local provincial government to restore Jewish heritage sites. The government's explicit goal is to attract Jewish money in the form of both tourism and investment by foreign Jews. In our conversation, the one Jew of Harbin had only praise for these efforts in which he had been deeply involved. "The restoration cost $30 million. It's unheard of here." "Everything was of the highest quality," Ben Kanan told me, adding that Harbin's Jewish heritage sites have the same official designation as Chinese landmarks like the Forbidden City. But one of the many sources on Harbin he shared with me was a long 2007 news article from a Chinese magazine by a journalist named Su Ling, whom he described as one of China's rare investigative reporters. The article, titled "Harbin Jews, the Truth," traced a very particular history. Not Harbin's Jewish heritage, but the Heilongjiang provincial government's attempts to capitalize on that heritage. The story began innocently enough with a social scientist cum real estate agent named Zhang Tiezhang, who discovered the prior Jewish ownership of many historic homes that he was supposed to demolish for a city planning project in 1992. Taking an interest, he studied the Jewish graves in Huangshan Cemetery, translating their Russian text with the help of a computer program. His timing was auspicious. 1992 was the year China established diplomatic relations with Israel, and in 1999, China's premier made his first official visit to Jerusalem. Also auspicious, Heilongjiang province, long reliant on declining industries like coal mining, had hit an economic slump. In 1999, Zhang Tiezhang published his idea in an article for a state news agency titled suggestions for the study of Harbin Jews to quicken Heilongjiang's economic development. This article made its way to the higher-ups in the Chinese government in Beijing, who dispatched an official to Heilongjiang's Academy of Social Sciences to intensify the study of the history of Harbin Jews. A center for Jewish studies was established with a massive budget, enabling unqualified people producing minimal research to enjoy trips abroad. Developing the travel industry and attracting business investments, the center's original website announced, was the tenet of our existence and purpose. In the years following, the government's $30 million produced far more tangible results, including not only the cemetery refurbishment, but also the transformation of the new synagogue into a Jewish museum, the reconstruction of the old synagogue and the Jewish secondary school, and the labeling of formerly Jewish-owned buildings as landmarks in the city's historic heart. This attempt to attract business investments by researching Jewish history seems, to put it gently, statistically unsound. Among the tens of millions of tourists to China each year, 40,000 annual Israeli visitors and even fewer Jewish tourists from elsewhere amount to a rounding error. And the idea that Israeli or other Jewish-owned companies would be moved to invest in Heilongjiang province out of nostalgia for its Jewish heritage seems unlikely at best. The only way to understand this thinking is to appreciate the role Jews play in the Chinese imagination. Most Chinese people know next to nothing about Jews or Judaism, but in a 2009 essay reviewing trends in Jewish studies in China, Li Hongsong, a professor of Jewish studies at Nanjing University, pointed out a common pattern in what they do know. "My students' first association with Jews is that they are rich and smart," he noted. "The shelves of Chinese bookstores," Song explained, "are lined with bestsellers on Jewish subjects." What Jewish subjects might those be? Well, some of those best-selling titles are Unveiling the Secrets of Jewish Success in the World Economy, What's Behind Jewish Excellence, The Financial Empire of the Rothschilds, Talmudic Wisdom in Conducting Business, and, of course, Talmud, the Greatest Jewish Bible for Making Money. Song claimed that this was not anti-Semitic, but rather some sort of Judeophilia. At a 2007 International Forum on Economic Cooperation between Harbin and the World's Jews, held in Harbin with dozens of invited Jewish guests who ranged from the Israeli ambassador to a group of Hungarian Jewish dentists, Harbin's mayor welcomed participants by citing esteemed Jews such as J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, neither of whom was Jewish. He then announced that the world's money is in the pockets of the Americans and the Americans' money is in the pockets of the Jews. This is the highest acclaim and praise to Jewish wisdom. Former Harbin Jews often remembered Harbin as a kind of paradise. "They owned the town," Irene Klerman, a daughter of former Harbin Jews, told me, describing the nostalgia that many Harbinsi, ex-Harbiners, expressed for their beloved city. "It was a semi-colonial situation. They had Chinese servants and great schools and fur coats." Or, in the words of her grandmother Rosa, later Ethel Klerman, in a 1986 interview, "Harbin was a dream." Rosa Klerman's husband, Irene Klerman's grandfather, was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered in Harbin during the Japanese anti-Semitic reign of terror, after which his lucrative business, he introduced indoor plumbing to Manchuria, and his high-end rental building were confiscated, leaving his family with nothing. And the Klerman family's horror stories had begun much earlier. Rosa Klerman was 5 during the 1905 Odessa pogrom, hiding in an attic for days on end while the neighborhood was ransacked and her neighbors murdered. The move to Harbin didn't quite prevent her family from being targeted, given that her husband also wound up murdered. "But my grandmother absolutely had a nostalgia for Harbin," Irene Klerman insisted. In her interview, Rosa Klerman admitted that everything changed in Harbin, but she spent far more time describing its glory, the steaks the family ate, the household staff, the children's private lessons. The ascent from pogroms to private lessons was dizzyingly fast, obscuring the community's equally precipitous decline. One Harbinsi descendant, Jean Ispa, told me how her father, an orphan, made his way to Harbin alone solely to study music, since Russian conservatories didn't take Jewish students. Running away from an orphanage, he collected scrap metal to buy a ticket to Harbin, where he was promptly jailed for entering the country illegally, and where musicians in the Jewish community bailed him out. "He was 16 when he made this journey," Ispa told me in wonder. "He gave concerts in Harbin. I even had the programs he played. Another Harbin exile, Alexander Galatsky, was 8 during the pogroms of the 1919 to 1920 Russian Civil War, when he and his mother repeatedly barricaded themselves in their apartment in Ukraine and listened to the screams of their neighbors being murdered and raped. When the ship fare his father sent from New York was stolen, their only hope was to go east to Manchuria, where his father planned to meet them. In reminiscences he wrote down for his family, Galatsky described boarding a cattle car to leave Ukraine. Mother has a bundle of old clothes with her. The soldier on guard of the cattle car is trying to take it from her. She clutches at it, crying, kissing the soldier's hand. We have no money or valuables, and the old clothes can be bartered for food en route. Without them, we would starve. After a life like that, Manchuria was paradise. Of course, one could tell the same story about Russian Jews who emigrated to New York, but in Harbin, where Russian Jews created their own Russian-Jewish bubble, their sense of ownership and pride was greater, and that pride made the story of their community's destruction into a footnote. Of the Harbinsi descendants I interviewed, most mentioned friends or relatives who were kidnapped, tortured, or murdered during the Japanese occupation. All had their families' hard-earned assets seized by Manchuria's various regimes. But in the next sentence, they would tell me again how Harbin was a golden age. An entire organization in Israel, Igud Yotzeisin, Association of Chinese Exiles, exists solely to connect homesick Chinese Jews around the world with one another through networking, social events, scholarships, and trilingual newsletters, which run to hundreds of pages. Until recent years, members gathered weekly in Tel Aviv to play mahjong, drink tea, and reminisce about the wonders of Harbin. Teddy Kaufman, who ran the organization until his death in 2012, published a memoir titled The Jews of Harbin Live On in My Heart, extolling the Jewish paradise. His father was the community president who'd wound up in a gulag. Harbin's Jewish golden age lasted less than one generation. Even before the Japanese occupation, things were unpleasant enough that leaving was, for many, a foregone conclusion. Alexander Galatsky, the boy whose mother bartered old clothes to feed him on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, kept diaries as a teenager from 1925 to 1929 that his daughter Bonnie Galat recently had translated. The diaries revealed an assumption that most teenagers don't live with. Everyone planned to leave, and the only question was where to go. He counted off his friends' departures to Palestine, to Russia, to Australia, to America, and waxed nostalgic about leaving as he capitalized in his diary, for good. My old classmate Misha leaves for Paris today, he wrote, describing one of many permanent goodbyes. For good, I think. It's a scary word, for good. Biro left, and Pinsky, and I think I'm leaving next year, too. And not with Mom and Dad, but alone. Galatsky's fears came true. The following year, he left for Paris via train and ship through Shanghai, Ceylon, and Suez. Later, he wound up supporting his parents after they fled Harbin with little more than old clothes. Many came to recall the community's destruction as if it was almost expected, like snow or rain. Alex Nachumson, who was born in Harbin and emigrated in 1950 at the age of 3 with his family, reports only very happy memories discussed by his parents. The Chinese never did anything bad to us, just the Russians and the Japanese, he told me by phone in Hebrew from his home in Israel, despite the fact that his family's assets were plundered by the Maoist regime. When my parents talked about Harbin, they only talked about their dacha, country home, the theater, the opera, he averred. When I brought up the kidnappings during the Japanese occupation, he verbally shrugged. That's just crime, he insisted. Crime happens everywhere. His parents survived all of these regime changes, he said cheerfully, between the raindrops, a Hebrew expression for evading repeated disaster. Losing everything they had was inevitable, like the weather. As the Russian-Jewish writer Sholem Aleichem once put it, Jewish wealth is like snow in March, melting and washing away. Later in our conversation, Nachumson mentioned almost casually that his own grandfather was kidnapped and tortured by the Japanese. It is hard to describe what exactly was wrong with Harbin's New Synagogue Jewish Museum, or as it said on my ticket, the Construction Art Museum, a name that comes from the building's current ownership by the Harbin Municipal Construction Department. One feels the overwhelming need to applaud this mostly Jewish museum's mere existence, to carefully delineate its many strengths, to thank the locals for their bountiful goodwill. For it did have enormous strengths, and the goodwill was abundant. Still, from the moment I arrived at the large domed building and entered its wide open space with an enormous Star of David decorating the floor, it only occurred to me later how ridiculous this detail was, since the floor would have been covered with seats when the synagogue was in use. I felt that creeping Jewish heritage unease, the unarticulated sense that despite all the supposed goodwill, something was clearly off. But then my actual Jewish heritage kicked in, consisting of centuries of epigenetic instincts reminding me that I am only a guest. I swallowed my discomfort and started snapping pictures. The Jewish history exhibition filled the second floor, the women's gallery of the synagogue. There, in vast arrays of photographs, I observed smiling, well-dressed people building synagogues, celebrating weddings, attending Zionist meetings, patronizing a library, posing in scout uniforms, working in a hospital, rescuing neighbors from a flood, and skating on the river. The displays were informative enough, even if their translated captions sometimes disintegrated into word salad. Beneath one portrait of a man wearing a prayer shawl and a tall clerical hat, for instance, the English caption read, "Judean Assembly Mark and Harbin Choir, leading Singer Graham Benefit Maxwell Minister Radical." I asked Eric what the original Chinese caption meant. He smiled apologetically and said, "I'm not sure." It was all admirably thorough, if a little garbled. But toward the far end of the gallery, on the part of the floor that had been constructed over the alcove where the Ark for Torah scrolls once stood, the actual alcove for the Ark is now a foyer leading to a restroom. I entered a little set of rooms whose contents puzzled me. The first room was dominated by a large wooden desk with a life-size white plaster sculpture of a bald and bearded Western man seated before an ancient paperless typewriter. The brass plaque in front of him read, "Real Workplace of Jewish Industrialist in Harbin." Confused by the word "real," I asked Eric if this was supposed to be a specific person. He glanced at the plaque and explained, "It is showing a Jew in Harbin. He is doing business." In subsequent rooms, more tableaux of frozen Jews unfolded. There were life-size plaster Jews frozen at a grand piano, a life-size plaster Jew frozen in a chair with knitting needles, and two child-sized plaster Jews frozen on a bed, playing eternally with plaster blocks. This, the brass plaque informed me, was the display of the Jews' family in Harbin. The plaque continued, "At the first half of the 20th century, not only was the display of the Jews' family simple, but also practical, and the children lived a colorful life there." The children's blocks, like the children, were devoid of color. Later, I discovered the unnamed inspiration for this display. Harbin's annual snow sculpture park, full of figures carved from blocks of manufactured snow. After the rooms full of frozen Jews, the photographs of mostly dead Jews resumed, dominated by real Jewish industrialists who brought about numerous economic miracles in Harbin, including the founders of Harbin's first sugar refinery, first soybean export business, first candy factory, and China's first brewery. The wall text explained how Harbin offered the Jews an opportunity for creating new enterprises and providing a solid foundation for their later economic activities in Europe and America. This was true, I suppose, if one thinks of Harbin as a kind of business school exercise, rather than a place where actual Jews created actual capital that was subsequently seized, transforming them overnight into penniless refugees, if they were lucky. One enterprise prominently featured in the museum, for instance, was the Skidelsky Coal Mine Corporation. The Skidelskys were among the Siberian Jews who provided the initial capital for Harbin, although initial capital is an understatement. In an account of his family's holdings in Prospect magazine, Robert Skidelsky, a member of the British House of Lords and a Harbin native, described how his great-grandfather Leon Skidelsky held the contract in 1895, prior to Harbin's founding, to build the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Manchuria to Vladivostok. The Skidelskys were one of only 10 Jewish families allowed to live in Vladivostok since the railroad desperately needed them. They held long-term concessions on 3,000 square kilometers of timber in Siberia and Manchuria, and enough long-term mining concessions to make them one of the region's largest employers. They continued supplying the railroad as it changed hands from the Russians to the Chinese to the Japanese. In 1924, Leon's son, Solomon, even charmed a local warlord into selling him a 30-year lease on a mine by repeatedly and deliberately losing to him in poker. In 1945, Solomon Skidelsky was still 9 years shy of running out the lease when the Soviets sent him and his brother to die in a gulag, and communists, first Soviet and then Chinese, seized the mines. Decades later, Lord Skidelsky filed his claim. In 1984, Lord Skidelsky recounted, "I received a check for 24,000 English pounds in full settlement for a claim for compensation that amounted to 11 million pounds." When he visited Harbin in 2006, local TV crews trailed him and presented him with flowers. The flowers were worth somewhat less than 11 million pounds. When I expressed my sense that the museum was telling only part of a story, Derek raised an issue that Ben Kanaan brought up with me repeatedly, that the museum focused exclusively on wealthy people, thus underscoring the idea that Jews are rich. Obviously, there were poor Jews here too, Derek pointed out. The building across the street was the Jewish Free Kitchen. It was only as I was leaving, and through the enormous mezuzah-less door, that I looked back at what was once the sanctuary and understood what exactly was wrong. Above the vast Star of David floor, the museum was dominated by an enormous blown-up photograph of a 1930s farewell banquet, its rows of Harbin Jews in their tuxedos gathered to say goodbye to yet another Jewish family fleeing, as Alexander Galatsky had put it, for good. Suddenly, the Jewish heritage miasma melted away, and the realization hit me. Nothing in this museum explained why this glorious community no longer exists. Harbin is a rather hideous city, its Soviet-style apartment blocks stretching as far as the eye can see. But the city's historic heart has been restored so thoroughly that if not for the Chinese crowds and street signs, one could imagine being in pre-war Europe. The restoration included turning the historic tree-lined Central Avenue into a pedestrian mall that doubles as an outdoor architectural museum, where each original building, 80% of which were once Jewish-owned, is labeled with a plaque describing its past. Unfortunately, the restoration also included installing loudspeakers that constantly blast high-volume Western music. When I arrived, they were playing Edelweiss, "Bless My Homeland Forever." The music made it hard to think. Derek pointed out the various restored buildings on Central Avenue and elsewhere in the neighborhood, the Jewish-owned pharmacy, the Jewish Free Kitchen, the Jewish People's Bank, and many private homes, all now occupied by other enterprises. The heritage architecture plaques affixed to each historic building couldn't have been more direct. This mansion, a typical one read, was built by a Jew. The most impressive Central Avenue building built by a Jew was the Modern Hotel, a building whose story captures the Harbin Jewish community's roller coaster of triumph and horror. The Modern Hotel was built by the Jewish entrepreneur Joseph Kaspe, and from the moment it opened in 1909, it was the height of Manchurian chic. The Modern wasn't merely a high-class establishment frequented by celebrities and diplomats. Its premises also included China's first movie theater, and the hotel frequently hosted theatrical performances, lectures, and concerts with seating for hundreds. Kaspe also created other modern-labeled luxury products like jewelry and high-end food. In other words, the Modern was a brand. When the Japanese occupied Harbin, they immediately set their sights on the Modern. But Joseph Kaspe was one step ahead of them. His wife and two sons had moved to Paris, where they had acquired French citizenship, so Kaspe put the Modern in his son's name and raised the French flag over the hotel. He assumed the Japanese wouldn't risk an international incident just to steal his business. He was wrong. In 1932, Kaspe invited his older son Semyon, a celebrated pianist, back to Manchuria for a concert tour. On the last night of his tour, Semyon was kidnapped. Instead of paying the bankruptcy-inducing ransom, Joseph Kaspe went to the French consulate. It didn't help. The kidnappers upped the ante, mailing Kaspe his son's ear. After 3 months, Semyon's body was found outside the city. When Kaspe saw his son's maimed and gangrenous corpse, he went insane. Friends shipped him off to Paris, where he died in 1938. His wife was deported and died at Auschwitz 5 years later. His younger son escaped to Mexico, where he died in 1996, refusing to ever discuss Harbin. The Modern Hotel is still in operation today. though at a few stars lower than the Holiday Inn where I stayed down the street. The large pink stone building with its glamorous arched windows and turrets still dominates Central Avenue, its girth expanding for an entire city block. Cyrillic letters spelling out modern running down one corner of its facade. Outside, I saw a long line of people winding its way down the street toward one end of the hotel, the hordes queuing in -10 degrees. The line, Derek explained, was for the Modern's famous ice cream. In Harbin, we love eating cold foods at cold temperatures, he said with a grin. It's true. The streets of Harbin are lined with snack stands selling skewers of frozen fruit. The Caspés figured this out and created China's first commercially produced ice cream, sold today under the chic English-language brand name Modern 1906. The 3-year error on the brand's founding date clearly troubled no one but me. Passing up the frozen treats, I went inside. The Modern Hotel's lobby was shabby and nondescript, except for an exhibit celebrating the hotel's illustrious history. It began with a bronze bust of Joseph Caspé, with wall text in Japanese and English, describing the accomplishments of the Modern Corporation and its founder, the Jew of Russian nationality, Mr. Alexander Petrovich Caspé. The Alexander was inexplicable. Joseph Caspé's actual first name appeared in Russian on the bust. As the wall text explained, this impressive Jew founded a flagship business in Harbin, integrated with hotels, cinema, jewelry store, etc. In recent years, the text continued, the cultural brand of Modern is continuously consolidated and developed. It then listed the numerous businesses held by this storied company, including the Harbin Ice Festival, which belonged to the Modern Corporation until the provincial government took it over a few years ago. Currently, the wall text gloated, Modern Group is riding on momentum and is shaping a brand new international culture industry innovation platform. Mr. Caspé's descendants would indeed be proud of this heritage, if any of them had inherited it. But after all, the Modern Hotel clearly honors its Jewish heritage. There, on its walls, were enlarged photos of Joseph Caspé's family, including his murdered son, sexy in his white tie and tails, frozen over his piano. There, under glass, were real historic items from the Caspé family, including silver candlesticks, an old-timey telephone, and a samovar. And there, in one particularly dusty glass case near the floor, were the Caspé collection of household utensils of Judaism sacrificial offerings, including an actual Passover Seder plate. I squatted down for a closer look at this display and saw that there were two plates inside it. The Seder plate had a bronzy Judaica motif, suspiciously familiar from my own American Jewish childhood. I squelched my skepticism until I saw that it was carved all around with English words. The second plate, a ceramic one, sported an Aztec-esque design with the word Mexico painted across the bottom, a 1980s airport souvenir. At that point, it became clear that any real historic items from the Caspés had long disappeared into some regime's pockets, and that this display had been sourced from eBay. I put my balaclava back on and went out into the cold again, past the hundreds of Chinese people clamoring for Caspé's ice cream, and headed to the old synagogue, which is now a concert hall. The result of a multi-million-dollar renovation project for which the one Jew of Harbin served as an advisor, the building is part of an entire Jewish block that includes the music school next door, which was once the Jewish secondary school. Ben Kanan was meticulous about the project, gathering and examining old photographs and descriptions to exactly replicate the Ark with its granite Ten Commandments motif, the pillars, the gallery that was once the women's section, and the seats with their prayer book stands. His only concession, he told me, was to make the bima, the platform before the Ark, wide enough to accommodate a chamber orchestra. When the person manning the ticket booth refused to let me peek inside, I bought a ticket for that night's string quartet. The old synagogue's interior shocked me. I don't know what I was expecting, but what I didn't expect was to be standing in a synagogue no different from every single urban early 20th century synagogue I've ever entered around the world, from my own former synagogue in New York City to others as far as London and Moscow and Cape Town and Buenos Aires and Melbourne. All those buildings around the world where you walk into the sanctuary, usually after passing an armed guard, and could literally be in any synagogue anywhere, which is exactly the point. The one Jew of Harbin did a marvelous job, so marvelous that as I walked into the large hall and saw the massive ark looming before me with its familiar Hebrew inscription imploring me to know before whom you stand, I instinctively listened for what part of the service I was walking in on. How late I was this time. Whether they were up to the Torah reading yet. My thoughts about how far back I should sit finally gave way to logic, and I looked at the seat number on my ticket. But when I took my seat in the third row, I still could not shut down my muscle memory. My hands went straight to the slot in the seat in front of me, reaching for a prayer book that wasn't there. I almost couldn't stop myself from reciting all the words I've recited in rooms like this, the words I've repeated my entire life, the same words recited by all the people who have gathered in rooms like this over the past 20 centuries, in Yavne and Pumedita and Aleppo and Rome and Marrakesh and Philadelphia and Mumbai and Sao Paulo and Harbin, facing Jerusalem. I was awed, googly-eyed. In that moment, I suddenly knew, in a vast sense that expanded far beyond space and time, before whom I stand. Then a Chinese string quartet walked up to the bima in front of the ark, and instead of bowing before the ark, they bowed before me. The lights dropped, and they played spectacularly well, Brahms' Hungarian Dance No. 5, and Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, and inexplicably, Cotton Eye Joe. And suddenly I was very, very tired. Somewhere in between the synagogues, the Belle Epoque-style bookstore named for Nikolai Gogol, the pool carved out of the frozen river with people swimming in minus 30 degrees, and the hundreds of dead Jews, I found myself in a Siberian tiger park, where 700 of the world's remaining tigers loll behind high chain-link fences or pace in isolation cells. In what resembles a tiger re-education camp. There, after riding a bus painted with tiger stripes through bare icy yards full of catatonic-looking tigers, I was encouraged to buy slabs of raw meat, since, as Derek explained, the facility only provided the animals with meager rations, with the assumption that tourists would make up the difference. The pull of curiosity, tainted by guilt, a feeling remarkably similar to my Jewish heritage unease, brought me to a woman selling buckets of raw pork slabs, which visitors feed to the tigers with tongs through the chain link. The woman selling the slabs also offered a crate of live chickens that I could alternatively have purchased as tiger food. This would have involved buying a live chicken and thrusting it into the tiger enclosure via a dedicated chicken chute. For the first time in my life, I bought pork. As I struggled to pick up slippery pieces of meat with the tongs, I remembered a moment in the Talmud, the great Jewish Bible for making money, when the rabbis claimed that the last thing created during the week of creation was the world's first pair of tongs, since tongs can only be forged with other tongs, a story whose haunting image of human limits transcends its lack of logic. When I succeeded in wielding the meat, the otherwise catatonic tigers pounced against the fence at me in a cartoon-like fury, rattling the Soviet-style barriers as they battled one another for the strips of flesh. I watched these almost mythic captives through a thick haze of pity and fear, helplessly flinging inadequate scraps at something powerful, beautiful, and trapped. Much later, I came across a National Geographic article claiming that this park was in fact a tiger farm, where these endangered animals, only seven of which still exist in the northeastern Chinese wild, thus outnumbering Jews in the region by 700%, were bred and slaughtered for trophies and traditional medicines. It all felt like an elaborate con, or if not quite a con, a display. The Harbin Ice Festival was the greatest display of all, surpassing my most fevered expectations. It was much, much larger and more elaborate than I had imagined from the photos and videos that had lured me to Harbin. I'd been amply warned by online strangers about how difficult the festival would be to endure, since it requires long periods outside at night in punishing temperatures. But once I was there, I was shocked by how easy it was. All I needed to add to my Harbin ensemble was a second sweater, a fourth pair of pants, a second pair of gloves, a fourth pair of socks, hand warmers stuck into my gloves and boots, and ice cleats, and I was good to go. I had been told that I wouldn't be able to bear the cold for more than 40 minutes. In the company of approximately 10,000 others who were also visiting that evening, a number relatively insignificant in the vastness of the festival, I stayed for 3 hours. Among the ice castles and ice fortresses clustered around a snow Buddha the size of a high school, I recognized shimmering, tacky neon versions of places I'd visited in real life, cataloging them in my brain like Benjamin of Tudela. The wild goose pagoda of Xian, the summer palace outside Beijing, the gate to the Forbidden City, Chartres Cathedral, the Campanile Tower near Venice's original Jewish ghetto, the Colosseum built by Jewish slaves brought from Jerusalem to Rome. I wandered around and through these flashing structures, their colors changing every few seconds as the LED wiring blinked within each ice block, passing over bridges and through moon gates and up staircases and down slides that wound their way through castles of ice. China is a place full of enormous, gaudy, extravagantly impersonal monuments made possible through cheap labor, from a 2,000-year-old tomb filled with 10,000 terracotta warriors in Xian to the medieval Great Wall outside Beijing to the 1994 Oriental Pearl Tower in Shanghai. The Harbin Ice Festival was the gargantuan fluorescent opposite of intimate or subtle. It was mind-blowing and mindless. It was the most astounding man-made thing I had ever seen. What was most shocking about the ice festival was the bizarre fact that all of it was temporary. In another month or two, the vast city would begin to melt. But unlike what I ignorantly assumed, the ice city does not simply vanish on its own. Instead, when the melting begins, 10,000 workers return to hack apart the millions of ice blocks, remove their electrical wiring, and then haul them out and dump them in the river. Like all cities, there is nothing natural about its creation, and also nothing natural about its destruction. Nothing simply disappears. As I left Harbin, I thought of Hannah Agra, the last Jew of Harbin, the crazy old lady who refused to leave the city, who died alone in 1985, 23 years after the last Jewish family left, in an office space that she had rejiggered into an apartment on the second floor of the old synagogue. It occurred to me as I passed through the industrial wastelands and endless high-rises on my way to the Harbin airport that maybe she wasn't so crazy. Maybe she didn't like being told to leave. Maybe she was physically enacting what all the other Harbinsis spent the rest of their lives trying to do, as they gathered in San Francisco and Tel Aviv to play mahjong and share photos of their samovars and fur coats. Maybe she wanted to keep the castle her family had built, preserved in ice. By the time I reached the airport, the Harbin Holiday Inn's breakfast buffet of dragon fruit and lychee nuts was a distant memory, and I was hungry. Fortunately, right next to my gate, there was a hip-looking eatery with historic black-and-white photos framed on trendy brick walls. Its sign read, Modern, 1906. I almost couldn't believe it, but yes, here it was once more. Joseph Caspé's business. As if responding to my private disbelief, a giant flat screen on a hip brick wall flashed a photo of Caspé's family, then one of Caspé's face. I stared at the photos before they blinked away, looking at this murdered family, and then at Caspé. The man who built a city only to lose his son, his property, and his mind. I suddenly felt shaken by the success of this business that had apparently persisted uninterrupted for over a century, by the sheer chutzpah of this open bragging about a corporate heritage, by the enduring quality of stolen goods. It was 20 below outside, but I bought an ice cream and a flavor labeled original. The sweet frozen cream melted in my mouth. Gone before I even put away my Chinese change. I was in the last row of the Air China plane leaving Harbin, the only Westerner on board. There was an intense smell of barbecued pork as someone in the row in front of me celebrated the year of the pig. I thought of Alexander Galatsky leaving Harbin for good, boarding the train to Shanghai and then the boat to Ceylon and on through the Suez Canal. A journey embarked upon 9 years after he first traversed the world at the age of 9 on the Trans-Siberian Railroad with his mother and her bag of old clothes. A cheerful animated panda on the screen in front of me explained the many safety features of the aircraft, including what to do if we should require, as the awkward English translation put it, emergency ditching. I thought of the Klermans, the Caspés, the Nachmsons moving between the raindrops, ditching as needed. Ditching as expected. Ditching a foregone conclusion. I watched the animation and remembered Benjamin Tudela, the chipper cartoon of the perilous journey around the world where every Jewish community was documented and counted and marveled at, full of cheery animated people who never felt the need to ditch, where cities never melted away. Within 2 minutes of takeoff, Harbin was no longer visible. Outside my window, I saw only snow-dusted farmland and the gleam of sunlight on the frozen river. The land was vast and empty. The enormous city was gone.